Welcome to Way Back When with your hosts, Lisa and Nancy.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Big Blend Radio's Way Back When History Show with Nancy and Lisa. You know, we're the publishers of Big Blend magazines, and we're also the mother-daughter travel team on the Love Your Parks tour. Today, we're going over to England. We love going to England. In fact, we used to live there for a couple years. Mm-hmm. Today, we're going to welcome Anthony Moss. This is my new word of the day. He's a rabologist. I love to learn new words. Mm-hmm. And he is the author of the newly released book, A Visual History of Walking Sticks and Canes. It's published through Roman and Littlefield, and you can go to antiquecanes.net to learn more. So welcome, Anthony. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Good to speak to you.
Yeah, we're excited about this because mm-hmm. as soon as we got the press release about your book, I'm like, what? What's a rabologist? Who knew about mm-hmm. this? And it's amazing.
Well, it's a good title. It's nice to say what you are, isn't it, really? It puts you into a certain category. Like bibliophile, I guess, for collecting books, maybe.
Yeah, so a rabologist is collecting canes and walking sticks. Yeah. So that's a collector.
It's not a curator of rabbits.
No.
No. And you're not rabbit either.
No, you're a rabbit.
No, I'm not a bunny, and I don't flap my feet, so I'm okay.
Walking sticks and canes, you know, we actually even have a Facebook group dedicated to taking a 1 hour walk. So we're all into walking. Nancy has a very big walking stick that a friend actually carved out of a tree, like he did the whittling and everything. But then getting through your book and looking at all of these images, these canes and walking sticks from around the world, from ancient times to now, just is incredible. The detail, the art, the craftsmanship. Mm-hmm. And some of them I'm going, they've got cloisonne, they've got porcelain, obviously ivory, and just, mm-hmm. you know, blew my mind. And I didn't really think of it as this treasure trove of history. It's kind of, is it like a symbol of wealth or stature by the type of cane you get?
Well, most canes were masculine. You could say it was their extension, although women did wear canes as well. But most canes, you know, pertain to masculine things like gambling and sex and power and stature. So in some respects, you know, it's for defense or to show that what he's worth. He carries a rather expensive cane, or maybe he's he has a cigarette, you know, a cigarette lighter or a hidden cigarette in the cane, or he goes to a bordello and he's got a whip. or whatever.
Okay.
Whatever. So in many respects, ordinary walking canes are very straightforward, but there is things such as gadget canes or multi-purpose canes, which had a dual purpose. So they weren't exactly what they looked like. They were more than what they looked like, and they had a hidden use. Mm. So, but it was, I'd say, although women wore canes, and you could say women really had a cane with cloth around it, and they call it an umbrella or a parasol. Men basically had something that a country cane or a day cane or, you know, something for the evening. And as you can see from history, it was a status to it, basically. So most of it was about status, but also it was fun and musing, different things.
The one thing that really blew my mind, and I do have a story about a musician, a drummer friend, who had an interesting thing stuck in his cane.
Is
one thing that really amused me was the camera stick, because we look at now people walking around taking selfies with their cell phone and having all these interesting tripods. And I'm like, you're copying the camera stick.
Yeah. Well, of course, mm-hmm. nothing is really new. I think what I really find out, especially in the Victorian times, Industrial Revolution, the canes were basically like a Swiss army knife. It had multi-use. In other words, although basically canes were not just for support, they were for status. Nevertheless, as Industrial Revolution grew and people got more inventive, you had all these canes with lots of different uses inside them. I can never really think that they were serious. Maybe they were for presentation. But obviously, a cane with a pencil in it was quite popular. Or a cane with a measuring stick for horse measuring or something of that nature would be useful to carry around. You know, if you're a gambler or you're at the races, it's good to have a pencil in your cane. Or you could be an artist who wanted to take, you know, wanted to quickly sketch. You know, he might have palettes in his cane and wanted to sketch something that he saw when he was out walking.
Oh, wow. That's pretty cool.
What about amulets with like drugs in them? Because you think used to have those little amulets, like they would open up their necklace and there'd be like opium in them. Laudanum. And did they ever do that in their canes?
Well, what they did, they had snuff for sure.
Awesome.
And and some canes contained a pipe, maybe an opium pipe occasionally. They weren't, they could easily contain an opium pipe. But fundamentally, as I say, they were for men's pleasure in a way. In other words, he had a cigarette, he had a pipe, he had some tobacco, or just simply it was defense so that he could defend himself. Mm-hmm. In other words, it could be a cudgel rather than just a heavy handle.
But that goes to our friend, a drummer. We put on a concert once because we're all musicians. And the one guitarist that was performing with us, he's passed away now. And we called him the devil because he did dabble in too many drugs and he got a little crazy. Rock and roll times. And so anyway, our little drummer friend, and he's, you know, performed with some of the greatest blues people on the planet. He's a little Willie. He's, you know, Hindu, very happy, spiritual, sweet man. But the devil apparently got a little stupid that night and they're all driving in the car and he gets out. He goes, "Be careful, Lisa. He's in that mode." I'm like, "What?" He says, "But I stabbed him. I stabbed the devil." I'm like, "What?" He goes, "He's got this little walking cane and because it's curved, right? And his little stick." And he opens it up and he's got a knife inside the cane. And he's like, "I stabbed him. He didn't know what I've got." His hidden knife.
Well, it was defensive.
He didn't kill him, though. He did not kill him, just so you know.
They had an awful lot. A lot of canes can take musical instruments, of course. You'll see.
Well, that's cool.
There was a street violin, which you could carry around as a, you know, you had flutes and piccolos, all sorts of things. I've got one trumpet
that's
cane.
Cool.
So it's a musician could certainly could carry a violin without it noticing being a violin.
Amazing.
It was a violin. Or he could have a ukulele or even a guitar. It sort of went in the cane. It may have been, and certainly a mouth organ or harmonica was very popular. So
that's cool.
The one thing I wanted to ask, you know, because you think about all these people creating these, there's the artists who are doing these beautiful carvings, but then you're getting into these gadgets and it's really like engineering. Did cane makers or creators become named? Like, did they get known like artists and musicians get known?
To some degree, some of the jewelry companies, like Fabergé, of course, was one where obviously they were court jewelers. And the same with Tiffany. They made luxurious canes as well as very ordinary silver canes. And it was to cater for their clientele who wanted to give maybe a present to somebody of something of value. But certainly, obviously, a lot of the jewelers made the occasional cane. You'll find there's one cane in my collection, which is an Austrian cane. And that is a very interesting maker in itself because he's... I just remember the name, and I can't remember his name at the moment. But he made bronzes, painted bronze, and it's got his mark on it. It's quite rare for them to make canes, but they did make cane handles. And I have to look at the name because I've forgotten the name myself.
He's all into it now.
I like the fact that you included
he's well known for those sort of things. I should remember it. God, my brain doesn't always work completely.
Okay, I like the fact that you included African canes. We spent some years living in Africa, and I know that you cannot touch a Zulu chief's cane. That's a big no. And the witch doctor of the tribe will bless the cane and impart powers to it. So their canes are... It's really special.
Well, that's why you get some folk canes definitely have a spiritual or magical power to them. A lot of the symbols on the sides, I would say witches, but whatever you want to call them, a showman or whatever the, you know, whatever the title, definitely have that sort of look. And I sometimes it's hard to see what the symbols are, but definitely they have a magical feel, because really country canes, or art populus it's called, are really very interesting because they're carved from a branch, a natural branch, and right. somebody makes a face in them. So you might get the green man, which is, you know, the figure you get in the forest, or you might get a nymph or a gnome or something, and cool. they just make it up from what they do. And they're wonderful. In fact, it's a whole section in its own right that people collect country canes. Some today carve canes, but generally speaking, if you went into Europe and even to America, some local guy would be carving a few canes and selling them, or he might carve them for himself. It becomes a family heirloom, basically. And they're wonderful because they're one-off.
Yeah.
And all he did was take a briar or some stick or twig, not twig because it's bigger than that, but and carve it into a walking cane or change its use. And there's just some wonderful examples. But that's a section in its own right.
It's fascinating because whittling here in this country, whittling is a big deal. And that's, you know, whittling your wood, it's carving wood basically. And that's a lot of walking sticks are done to this day that way for, you know, even hikers. What I know that you collected, you know, antique books or still collect, you're a collector, period. Collect books and then also Victorian furniture, you're and your wife, and she started getting you the canes. But how many canes? I mean, there's a cane society, antique cane society. I had no idea. So I'm excited to learn about this. But how many canes do you have in your own collection, do you think?
Well, I've got just over 2,500 canes.
Wow.
In my collection. Well, it's not madness. I've been very selective. But if you go to, in the States, in North America, there are a number of collectors, I should say, and dealers, of course, but who have larger collections. Some of them are getting a bit old these days, but there's still a big following, as I think you saw Cane Mania was the International Cane Society. And that really took its life from America. From the cane collectors and the enthusiasts in the States. And they had different, every 2 years, they had a cane conference. Chicago was the last one in the States. But really, Europe took over for a time, and we had Paris, from Paris, Milan, and then London, and then Geneva in 2016. And it brought together enthusiasts as well as collectors, as well as, you know, as well as dealers. So you could buy canes, and also the lecturers gave you an idea, gave you information. You shared information with people, and that's part of the network, you could say. But there's so many, the more I collected, the more I realized how many different types and ideas were created for the cane. Besides, if you go to the earlier canes, they're simpler. I mean, if you look at something like the Protestants or the founding fathers, they would have had a long, simple cane with a simple ivory handle. But basically, they were also what were called piquet, which is the Huguenots made them. In fact, Fabergé is a Huguenot, funny enough, and they had to escape from France because the Protestants were being persecuted. And they escaped to Holland and to Russia and to England, where they were welcomed. Eventually, of course, the ones from Holland decided that Spain might be taking over, so they went to the States and became, you could say, the Pilgrim Fathers, or certainly the early American settlers, the Protestants, certainly.
So you get to really learn history through all of by you know, accumulating these and collecting these canes and walking sticks. What do you think is the oldest cane that you have?
It's 1850. Sorry, 1650. Wow. 1650.
1650. Are you kidding me?
No. These piquet. What happened with piquet? The Huguenots made piquet canes, and they inserted silver tubes as decoration. A piquet is more like a fabric, not a fabric, but the design. It's more or less a linen design of decoration, and they were quite popular. They're very very simple, but they had all sorts of swirls on them, and they were really very. They brought into England the French style, which became very popular. I mean, really, it was France that started. Louis started really the whole idea of fashion and haute couture. It is France, and it's still France when you think about haute couture. It's still that magic of the, of the catwalk and fashion. And nevertheless, they started this fashion to some degree, and flamboyant dress, and they needed canes. Partially it was status, but also it was very much to support themselves. The women certainly had very high heels and very tall wigs, so you needed something to keep upright.
So you need to balance.
You needed a cane.
Well, women are using canes now. You see a lot in musicians doing it and actors. It's kind of a stage, a stage act.
You see it in the catwalks. In it, there's lots of fashion shows. They're all wearing canes because it is cool. It's but what's fascinated me is how each era produced a different sort of design. And for beauty, you look at Art Nouveau, which was a very short period from about 1890, just before the First World War, and that was very feminine, very full of nature, curves, female form, and insects. And that was really quite fussy, but such beautiful works, such design, it flowed. And then really, in theory, when the when we got to the 20s, it wasn't called actually Art Deco of the 20s, it was called Art Modern. And it led to American Modern as well later on. But only, in fact, it wasn't called Art Deco until 1968. When they called it that name. But again, the canes in that period, for a short period, certainly before the Second World War, were certainly much, what people don't realise what was achieved, what you could buy. It's not just the Fred Astaire dancing cane, which is very smart, you could say. But they're a lot of them are simple things, but the Art Deco period, they introduced Egyptian revival. I mean, Carter had found Tutankhamun's tomb, and a lot of the ideas and the vision lent themselves to cane decoration, and then they also looked at Incas and or the Mayans, and they took different ideas and materials from different places, and they made luxurious canes. But people have almost forgotten that there is a period of Art Deco in that respect. It's sort of canes went out of fashion to a great degree. I mean, what they say is that when the motor car came around, people couldn't be bothered to carry a cane and a briefcase and everything else. So they didn't need it. They just got in the car. Nobody walked anymore.
Yeah, you're not displaying yourself on the street.
People stopped walking in some respects. In fact, what is interesting, by the way, Lisa, is when you look at the middle class, certainly England, because we started the Industrial Revolution, which obviously spread to Germany, France, Austria, and to America in some form. But fundamentally, this whole period was really for status. It's only later that people designed sort of multi-purpose canes, but basically canes were part of your dress. You wouldn't be seen out without carrying a cane or wearing a cane.
Wow.
It just was not you. You could not, you wouldn't be seen in public. It would be an inappropriate, should we say. You'd be undressed.
Oh. So, Anthony, in regards to a cane, could a cane indicate your family heritage? So if you get an heirloom as a cane as an heirloom in your family, like you're up in the attic and you find this cane, can that lead to understanding more about your ancestry?
Of course. I mean, you've got canes. If you go back further, remember the Indians were given status canes by Abraham Lincoln, and that basically was to show their status. And so obviously they're passed on from one generation to another generation. There were canes for the Civil War, and obviously had provenance and were passed on just as field commissions were passed on to the family, because it was a historic thing for the family. So yes, you can trace people. And also a lot of the American canes for campaigns for presidential campaigns, for political campaigns. And so there is some sort of, you can say I was there, or exhibitions. So there's a cane that ties you to the exhibition. It may have been the State Fair, it may have been something with a map in it to show that to help you, a one-off thing.
Oh, I like that with a map. Oh my gosh, yeah. I want the map one. That's my thing. Yeah. I want one with a globe on top.
Yes, yes.
And a map.
Well, you get clock. I mean, watches were the obvious cane to have because you could before pocket. You know, while you had pocket watches before you had wrist watches, you carried it in a cane. It's perfectly accessible, and you had time. But
you can carry canes, a flask.
I've got canes where they're almost historic, where you've got provenance in the sense that it's a series of family that have added their name on the cane. So there is it's almost a memorial cane, you could argue. So it just says so-and-so when he was born and when he died, and each generation has another silver band to add to the cane's provenance.
Oh, it's like a family tree.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fascinating. Cool. Because also I was thinking the fact that some of them had all these uses that, like when you're saying a tape measure or a measuring stick inside one, that might be for someone who is more into like a mason or, you know.
Well, the masons had canes. I mean, a lot of these specialist canes were subliminal. In other words, they were to show you belong to something. So Masonic canes obviously had Masonic symbols. And it would show somebody who wasn't a Mason that you were a brother. Similarly, you had tradesmen's canes, which showed that you were a doctor because it might have a skull, or it might have some other instruments in it, or maybe it was just simply a foot measure because you dealt with shoes and wanted to measure people's feet, or it could even be a seamstress with a few. Tacks and things in it, so you could, check the length of the skirt or the hem and carry on her work, so she could carry it with her.
I don't think
you do not want dental.
But I don't think a doctor should have a skull. That's kind of, I wouldn't go to a doctor that had a symbol on his cane that was.
It showed the students carried a skull. Skulls took on different significances in Mentamori. But as a skull, could show that you were a doctor. Some of the canes that PK canes have smell things in the for ward off smells. But basically, cool. The reason for especially the Victorians and maybe the Americans were the same. They had a fascination with death. Lots of the children died young, and it was also the start of photography. So. You would dress your dead child up and have a family portrait done. And basically it was to say in a Christian way, remember you're mortal. You know, so it has a message to say that really, you know, you don't live forever. So what you do in this life counts the next. Mm. And so it's that sort of symbolism. And there was this whole business of death, well, especially if you take the First World War, people died. And again, it was a memorial to them in a way. It was sort of, you had canes which are half normal and half skull. So it showed this transition. I don't think people thought differently in those days in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, we're squeamish about different things today.
Right.
But again, people felt the mortality. There was such a lot of infant death, and people died younger. I think death and memorial were with them. I mean, in Victoria times, we had memorial canes and we had it had bands with people's hair in them, or a brooch with somebody's hair to remember them.
That's right.
My grandmother, she's from England, and well, she's long passed now. She had lockets of all of her kids' hair in tissue paper, all tied up with little ribbons and little notes on them. And so that was a whole historic thing that she kept forever and ever. And then when she passed, everybody got a little locket of their own hair with a ribbon and a note, which was, I don't know if that's a British
I think it may be bizarre, but how when you've got no television and no films, but how do you remember people? Photographs were in, obviously, and so photography was in studio was very important, especially taking pictures of children. I mean, children not dying, but children were photographed and families were photographed. It was a something you could remember people by. Mm. And I think the cane also had that same significance. Mm. That if you had a locket, not say a locket, but you had some memorial cane or a cane that belonged to somebody, you're close to them. Mm. So if their name's on, even if they've died, you own that cane and it's your connection with your past generation.
And you know they've held it. They've held it. So there's some kind of connection.
And you would wear it. Maybe you'd wear it just on Sundays.
Mm, that's what you're saying in your book. You talked about that too. Yeah, one thing too, we talk about the mortality and death and family, but some of the canes are hysterical. They're like little clown faces and little cartoonish. They're fun.
Music. But can you imagine if you were very interested in Shakespeare and you went to a Shakespeare play, you might well have a cane with Shakespeare's head on it.
Right.
So that you could show that you were keen on Shakespeare plays. In other words, you would wear it for those performances to show that as an example, I've got canes that have interesting cartoon characters, you could say, or characters from books like The Hunchback of Notre Dame. I have Hunchback of Notre Dame cane because it was, an interesting story, maybe. I've got Punch and Judy because that was, again, a different Punch and Judy because it was it reminded them maybe of the cartoon or the story, and people, and maybe again it was a memory you could keep. So maybe it was important that way.
I want Postman Pat on mine. I want Postman Pat and his black and white cat. That's what I remember from British TV when I was a kid. Postman Pat. It's kind of interesting what you say, too, because nowadays when people go to a concert or a theater production, they buy, like if a musician's touring, they'll buy the T-shirt with the tour information, what cities they went to. But back then it's a cane. But you've got to think you had to be well to do to afford a cane every time you went somewhere like that.
Well, look, the majority of people had bent canes. I say, just simple canes that you wore and threw away. But most people had a Sunday cane, which they took to church so they could look smart. If you were reasonably well off, you'd have 30 or 40 canes. You'd have a country cane, a morning cane, a day cane. Sounds silly, but canes that matched your outfit. If you had an outfit, if you had a Pacific outfit, you might have a parasol that matched the outfit. It's perfectly normal, and certainly. People collected canes all the way through that matched their attire. So it went with the status or what they were wearing.
It was not
for everyday use. It was for special occasions, you could say. They might have brought it out once a year, maybe for their birthday, I don't know, or a wedding.
Or maybe for Christmas, you have a Christmas cane.
But Santa, I love this. I got so excited going through your book because to me, again, it's art. And what's beautiful that this is a book is you've made it accessible for the world to be able to connect with these canes. For me, I never thought about canes being an heirloom. I just never thought about it other than I love walking sticks. So I do have to go into the difference between a cane and a walking stick. Is it to do with age and your mobility or?
Yes. You wear a cane, but you walk with a stick. That's the simple saying. So in other words, when you need support, it's a stick.
It's a stick.
You wear a cane because it's part of your dress and it looks smart and you feel proud to have, you've got your hat or whatever a scarf and gloves, and you've got a nice cane. And this is obviously, to some extent, a different era. But today, there are dandies. There are people that like dressing up.
Dandies.
And they don't want to just dress up in jeans. They want a waistcoat, a nice jacket, nice shoes, and they want to look smart.
Got to have a hat. If you've got a cane, you've got to have a nice hat. Come on.
You can't look smart. It's very hard to wear a cane with a pair of shorts. But yeah, you can
do whatever you want if you're getting canes. I want to ask about that. You've got this collection of over 2,500 canes. Do you keep them, in the cool, dark place? Do you have to make sure they're at a certain temperature when you store them?
Well, my wife was unfortunately was not that happy. I started collecting canes. A few
her
was
fault, though. She started it.
So I've had to be very careful where I keep them. In other words, I've got some on show in the house, Most are in proper stick stands, but basically what I've got, I constructed two things, planning chests. So there was the drawers, and I lay the sticks in the drawers, and the canes in the drawers. And up, this room up here is one of my offices, and I created this room for the canes and for my book canes. So I've got drawers here, which I can pull out, and there's canes in them.
So okay.
In other words, maybe as an example, whether you can see that, I'm not sure.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, look, a skull.
Yeah. That's a Mentor Mori cane. It's walnut, and you can see the little
ladybug.
A ladybug.
Yeah, ladybug. Yeah. You can say it's partially amusing, but again, it's.
That's cute.
But now that's interesting with the walnut, because you say that's walnut, but I would automatically.
That's walrus.
Oh, walrus. Walrus.
It's ivory, but it's not an elephant.
Okay. So yeah, they use walrus too.
The walrus tusk.
Well, they made canes from whale bone. They made canes from anything they could, really, from cabbage to you name it. Anything that could actually made into a cane and dried, material-wise, they used it because it was it was available.
So do you wear a cane?
Sorry?
Do you wear a cane?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
Not all the time. Well, partially at my age, I need some support, so I also use a cane, to be honest.
Okay.
Or use a stick. But I do wear a cane because I'm going to an opening of an exhibition tomorrow, and of course I'll wear a cane. It's a picture gallery, so obviously I must wear a cane. It's part. How can I go with undressed?
No, you need to wear a cane. Yeah,
exactly. So when you go and look for canes and start when you see them, where are you getting them? And how do you know if that's a good purchase?
Well, collecting the canes was very interesting. I needed to get information. It's one of those things. I was very green, obviously. I'd never collected canes. I had a few canes. And when I started talking to the dealers, they started bringing me canes. And they knew more about the canes than I did. So essentially, most of my canes came from dealers in the past. I've been more adventurous in more recent times by going to online auctions. But fundamentally, I didn't have the information, and the people that did have the information were collectors and dealers in canes. They'd been, you know, I needed their advice, and they helped me build a collection. And eventually, as I started writing the book, I realized there were such big gaps in areas I hadn't been collecting or hadn't got an example
for.
Uh-oh. But I wanted my collection to be representative. I didn't want it to be the most expensive canes you could possibly buy and being very rare. And some of those canes can be forgeries as well, because there's a reason, you know, if you're going to have very expensive canes, somebody can make money out of it by pretending it's something it isn't.
Yes.
And so, you have to be fairly careful. And although by buying more canes and seeing them, you get a knowledge, you get an idea, you can almost start giving a date to them and where they've come from. You know, because by handling anything over time, you gain the knowledge. But most of my canes, I was supported by a number of dealers and still am. Mm. So they'll still come to me and say, look, I've just bought a cane from a client. You might be interested. And if I'm very weak, I might say yes, but what's your best price?
Uh-oh.
Well, I've got to be a bit disciplined because I've run out of space.
Yeah.
You know, as you said, you do have to find ways of storing these things so they don't impose themselves on you.
But it's interesting when you talk about getting that whole kind of collection through the years and through the different types. That, I mean, COVID must have been, especially the beginning of the pandemic, was that an especially naughty time for you to get in there and start like watching the online auctions, because none of us were allowed out?
The online auctions have actually boomed. I watch the online auctions all the time because it gives you an idea of price. I mean, the online auctions are the wholesale price, even though you've got dealers, premium, and you've got a buyer's premium or whatever it is, and VAT or a sales tax. But it does give you an idea of what things are worth. But if you want something rare, you have to go to a dealer, because what dealers have got, they've got people they buy from, private dealers who are selling part of their collection. And things that come up with them, yes, they make a profit, but overall, when you look at the price I've had to pay to build a collection, it evens itself out.
Mm-hmm.
So in monetary terms, maybe I've paid in UK pounds, £400, maybe what, $350 or something, average it out. But some canes I've had to spend a lot of money on because they're rare.
Mm.
I mean, there's one cane in my book, which is, to my mind, the rarest I've ever seen. It's a gadget cane, and it's really what they call it, is escritoire. It's got writing instruments in it. It's got ink wells and pens and a watch in the top. And
wow,
it's the rarest of the gadget canes. That's about 1850, Germany. But it is magnificent, and it's just, you know, it's so rare. The other cane I've got, which is the Lucifer, which is a clockwork cane, and you'll see it on my Instagram site. I mean, that's just rare because it's clockwork. It's not. It's a gadget. It's a gadget cane in a way, or it's certainly an automaton, I should say. So you wind up, press a button, and the face moves, and the eyes roll, and the tongue comes out. No, but it's,
well, see, I love that stuff. I love that.
Yeah, but they were, in some respects, they amuse children, or maybe the opposite.
Well, I bet.
What I'm saying is, it's
It's a wind-up.
How do you break the ice with a pretty lady? You bring out your cane, and it's amusing, and you both laugh. So it's an introduction. And maybe people have them for that reason.
Party.
It wouldn't show the shock, but you press the button, and maybe the ears flapped or something. I think it's amusing in the sense that you've got to think in that particular era, whether it's America, Europe, anywhere else, things are much simpler. People, I think, had a different idea of comedy. What was amusing? You could say the silent films. In other words, it was gesture, wasn't it, really?
Yes.
Rather than words.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so to have a cane that had, that had a cat on it, you pressed a button and the tongue came out, or the head moved, was magical. You couldn't see why. And yet, really, they were, you wouldn't necessarily use them as every day, but if you went to a party maybe, or something, or meeting somebody, it'd be a conversation piece.
It gives me the giggles. Things like that give me the giggles. And I get into trouble. Like, there's that TV show Seinfeld, and they had they were in a theater, and Jerry Seinfeld, the comedian, puts a Pez dispenser, just brings out the Pez dispenser. They're in the theater, and there was a solo piano concert going on. Yeah. And so Elaine looks at the Pez and gets the giggles, gets hysterical. Her laughter now destroys the piano recital, and she has to leave the theater. But it's exactly that kind of thing that gives me the absolute giggles, right? Nancy, I know you're bad about that too.
I would like a cane that has some wine in it and a little glass.
Well, they did. They were, yes, I'm afraid. Again, this is men. Probably women could take them too. But a typical cane, you would have a glass, and you'd have some whiskey in it maybe, rather than wine.
All righty then.
But brandy or something, yeah. And that was quite common. I mean, if you're out in the country and you needed, it was cold, or in the city, you might take it out and have a tipple.
A little tipple.
Yes, well, we call it a tipple. I mean, whatever you want to call it. A shot.
I like it.
There must be a name for it, really.
It's
I like a tipple. That's a good. Yeah, it's a little tipple, like sherry time. I remember sherry time.
That's how you get tipsy.
Well, it might be a flask. What you have, you're at the races, and it's a bit cold, and you're not near a bar or something, and you haven't got a bottle on you, or a flask, but you could still have it in your cane.
Oh, I love this.
I like this.
When you get a cane, do you kind of, like, if I got one, even though you research and you know, okay, this is where it's from, once you get it in your possession, do you start to research things? Just kind of like, I would go nuts. Like, I used to do beadwork, and I got so involved in the history of beads and how it was currency, depending on where you were in the world and the different colors. Mm-hmm. And I could write a book at that point. Mm-hmm. I never did my business because I was so fascinated by the meanings of
research.
Each bead.
Mm-hmm.
So once you get a new cane in your possession, do you kind of geek out that way and start, you know?
Well, some Some lend themselves to research because they're made by, I mean, I've got one cane in the book which is fascinating to me. It's the Norse. It's a dirigible. It represents, or should we say, commemorates a very important flight. 1926, Italy makes two rigid balloons. Airships. They're not like a Zeppelin. It's still a rigid, but it has mobility, so it can fly, and so it can move around. You could say, and the Crown Prince of Japan came to see it. Mussolini came to see it, and Emerson, who found the North Pole, who beat Scott for the North Pole, was the pilot, and it was the first time they'd flown from Europe to America, or from the Atlantic to the Pacific, you could say. And they used an airship because basically, if they had a plane and it crashed, they would know they couldn't land it, but you could land an airship. But basically, they made two, and it was the 3,000 newspapers around the world reported this event. It was very exciting. And the cane I've got, which is a French cane, represents that balloon, the Norse, and it represents that Pacific event. Now, when you say canes with provenance, it represents an event. So there is a provenance to that event. I don't know anything else other than if you go and Google it, you can see the event and you can see the balloon and you can see the history of it.
Wow.
So this cane is specifically historic. Somebody decided to actually represent that event and commemorate it.
That's amazing.
So it's a lovely thing. This is so, you do research it, you find the cane, and then you realize there's a history behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, in a way, I wrote the book, because how do you pass on? It's such a shame. All these people with knowledge, when you get the manufacturers of, whether it's umbrellas or whatever they did, once they die out and their business stops, there's no record. Mm-hmm. Most of it gets, they went out of the business, everything gets burnt. It goes in and say, people, it's just become scrap. But nobody actually keeps resources. It's hard to find the history. And it's such a shame that there's a need to pass it on. There's a need to pass on some sort of ideas. My book is not really completely researched because basically I could go on and on and on. It's a never-ending story. You can find more things about what you've got. You can discover hidden gems that you didn't realize you had.
Yeah.
The fact about the book was to really... to have some, it's not a Bible, but the thing is, I didn't want it just to be a collection of canes. I wanted it to interest students or even collectors, even the people in fashion, even dandies, to understand how canes came about and why they're still important. In other words, it hasn't gone away. They may not be sort of as popular as they were because obviously people just don't wear them, but people still wear them today. And you can still buy the most wonderful, wonderful canes today, whether they're country canes carved with pheasants on them, or whether they're really high-value canes that are still made and people buy them. It's not totally dead.
No, and I love what you've done, because you made my head turn around. Like, whoa, we've got to look at this. It's something, it's fascinating. I had no idea there's societies about it. You really opened my eyes to it. One thing before you go, I did want to ask. The Scottish with their clans, do they have do the Scots put their clan symbol on their canes?
Well, there's no clan. You get what you get is you get Masonic symbols. You get also not just tradesmen. You get really apprentices, especially in France. You had really apprentice canes. basically they were guilds, you could say. In fact, the whole business about the Masonic side is really a craft guild. And these canes represented, not necessarily Masonic, but some of the craft guilds had canes which showed their status or showed they belonged to the craft guild. Or it might show that they were dandies. In other words, it was a symbol, single to something, a signal to people of a like mind that they were... I'm not saying you couldn't get a Scottish cane which had a clan on it. I've not really seen clan canes as such. They're more to do with association. It's more to do with belonging to something. It's more to do with, as I said, status. more than, well, there are canes, obviously, that tell you I'm an active Mason, or I belong to a craft guild, or I'm a tradesman. My symbol is the rat, and I've got a rat on the top of my cane. I'm a rat collector. Or I'm a doctor, and I have a skull, or I have curled snakes around my cane to show I'm a medical person.
Oh, you see, yeah, so,
that count the snakes.
Yeah, so you could get that. And then other canes had religious significance.
Mm-hmm.
The snake, specifically, because it sheds its skin, is reborn.
Mm, the rebirth,
It represents Christ. It is rebirth.
Mm.
The skin falls off, but a new snake arises.
Mm-hmm.
And you get this sort of symbolism, which has a religious significance to lots of people. But whether it's a snake or whether it's some other animal, it could have magical significance in itself. In other words, it might be a hidden meaning, but also people were fascinated with hands, for instance. Hands could show that you're a Mason, could you grasp people a certain way, or it could be just friendship. So you got hands on canes, maybe two hands holding hands to say, I'm a Mason.
Oh.
Or simply, it was just something they were fascinated with. Or it might be that they were, they might be made by Pacific people. Picane, it's not Picane, it's Picane Island. This is where the Mutiny of the Bounty, landed. They made canes for tourists that stopped there. And they sold them to traveling.
Yeah. That's right. You said in prison, and those prisoners of war that were prisoners making of war, canes.
Because again, they needed, look, in all times, prisoners needed to supplement their income and their food. And whether it was America, whether it was France, people were allowed to make, produce things and sell them at different times. And they could make some extra money so they could feed themselves. It happened in Napoleon times. It happened for the Boer War, where again, they were, the craftsmen came in, they were sitting there doing nothing, you could say, and what they could find on the beach, they could make into a cane and sell it.
That's amazing.
Same with during the war, trench art. People had things, they weren't fighting all the time. They had big periods where they could do absolutely nothing. So they carved a cane, maybe a memorial to the war. Maybe it had all the battlefields on it, or the battles they fought. Or maybe it was just made of bullets, and it was something that material they had around, which either they could sell or basically could bring back home as a memento of the war.
I wonder if that's where the word whittling, whittle your time away when you're whittling wood. I wonder if that's where that, came from. That I always look at words and where they come from, the etymology of it, because it's fascinating. I'm whittling my time away. There's some that just, and then the wind up. When you, in England, everything goes, it's a jolly good wind up. And now I think of, now every time I hear wind up, I'm going to think about cat's tongues jumping out of a cane.
I personally think it was amusing children. I think really when you went to see your grandchildren and you had an amusing cane where the cat tongues came out of the cats, they would be fascinated by it. It was simple things. I mean,
Punch and Judy. That's awesome. That's amazing.
I mean, the French made automatons, most wonderful automatons, by the way. Where we have these moving cats and things playing instruments. Clockwork, basically. But Victorian people were fascinated by these things. It was to amuse during the day.
That time is also when we were doing the model trains and also those, the miniature. Like the model trains and the little they'd come out at Christmas time with people skating and like the little miniature houses.
Yeah.
I think it's all kind of connected with that. It's amazing. Thank you so much, Anthony. Yeah. It has been such a pleasure talking with you and your book. Just, wow.
It's an eye opener.
Well, there's an awful lot to impart, and it's very kind of you to meet both of you and hope that, it helps to gain a greater audience of something that really is very fascinating and is a wonder, and there's an awful lot still to discover.
There really is. Now, it's a great every time subject. I'm in a museum, I'm going to be looking for canes.
For canes, yeah.
I know. You're making me look at things differently, not just canes. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, there's more like this that we should be looking at. Everyone, again, the book is by Anthony Moss. He's a rabologist. It is called A Visual History of Walking Sticks and Canes. It's published by Roman and Littlefield. And you can go to his website, antiquecanes.net. And Anthony, give everyone your Instagram handle. What is it? Antiques underscore canes. Antique underscore canes on Instagram. Follow him there. And of course, keep up with us at bigblendradio.com. Thank you so much, Anthony. Thanks, Anthony. Take care.
And you. Thank you for your time. Appreciate it. Hopefully one day we'll meet in person.
That'll be fun.
That'd be fun. We'll bring a cane.
If you ever get to the UK, my home, I'd be happy to give you a guided tour and tea or whatever.
That's right. Oh, cool. Oh, we'd love to. We'd love it.